And welcome to another Behind the Panels one-shot special. I'm Richard Gray.
And I'm David McVeigh.
For this special, we had the pleasure of chatting with Laramie Taylor. Laramie's forthcoming book, A Voice in the Dark, has been picked up by Top Cow as an ongoing series after a successful Kickstarter campaign. It's been described as Strangers in Paradise meets Dexter. What you may not know about Laramie, of course, is that he writes, draws, and tones the entire book with his mouth and the use of a tablet. We chat to Laramie about the creation of the book, breaking into the industry, and what we can look forward to in this very, very inspirational chat we've had.
It's a fascinating interview. It really is.
It's really a lot of fun, and we definitely hope to get Laramie back at some stage in the future. But for now, we really hope that you enjoy this interview. And we're welcoming Laramie Taylor to Behind the Panels. Laramie, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, congratulations on Voice in the Dark being picked up as an ongoing series. I know this has been a project in your life for a while now.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's something that I've been working on in various forms off and on for a number of years now. But as a comic book, trying to get it picked up only about a year. I think I did the Kickstarter that launched all of this probably back in, I think it was October 2012. So we're coming up on about a year.
Wow. And just for people, particularly here in Australia, who may not have heard of the comic before, could you give our listeners a little bit of an idea what Voice in the Dark is all about?
Sure. Terry Moore, who does Rachel Rising right now, started with Strangers in Paradise. He summed it up for me, gave me a great blurb. He called it Strangers in Paradise meets Dexter. And that's pretty much what it is. It's a very female-driven comic, but it's about a young woman who is becoming a serial killer.
And was it a choice from the very beginning to make your protagonist a female?
Yes, it was.
And the reasons for that?
Well, actually, the whole thing started, it was going to be a horror parody that I was doing, and I was wanting to play with all of the tropes and conventions and kind of turn them upside down, so... You know, in the bad horror movies of the 80s that I grew up in, you know, it was always the ethnic character that died first. So I thought, well, she'll be the one that survives. And then I decided, well, what if she survives because she's the killer? And it kind of grew out of that. And it originally was going to be a very campy, tongue-in-cheek horror spoof. And somewhere along the way, I kind of realized that I had a lot more interesting things going on than I thought I would. And if I took it more seriously, I might be able to really do something with it. And so I did.
Yeah, speaking of the tone, it comes from a very dark place, doesn't it?
Kind of, yeah. I think there's a bit of humor in it, and the humor, I think, becomes more prevalent in ongoing, you know, future issues. But it's overall, yeah, it's a fairly dark book.
I guess part of one of the things I was reading about you was that the book sort of came out of a previous couple of projects that you'd been working on. There was Hellstarter, of course, of which there were a couple of books out there. At what point did you decide to transition into comics from prose?
Well, I was kind of transitioning back into comics from prose. I started as a stage writer and director. And that's where my background mostly is in theater. I've been a caricature artist since I was about 14, but I started writing comic book scripts. Originally was trying to get into screenplays, TV writing, and my TV writing coach, who is an executive producer on a number of shows and has a whole bunch of writing credits, told me that unless I can immediately move to Hollywood and have reliable transportation, I wasn't really going to get any screenwriting gigs. And that was not an option. So he suggested I look into writing for comics because it's fairly similar in the way that it's written as an ongoing serial. But comics are a lot more lenient about where you live. You don't have a whole bunch of writers in a writer's room doing, you know, weekly meetings and running scripts through the showrunner and everything. So he suggested I look into comics. And so I started writing for comics. And I had a book that actually got picked up by Archaea. that I was writing. It was being drawn by an artist named Duncan Eagleson, who used to draw for Vertigo back in the heyday of Sandman. He drew on Sandman. He drew Shade the Changing Man. He did the Anne Rice adaptation of The Witching Hour for another company. And so he was my penciler, and my wife was my colorist. And she was doing direct painting colors over pencils. And his page rate ended up becoming to be, you know, too much for us to be able to handle. Some situations we thought were going to be bringing us some money didn't. And her health crashed at about the same time, in part because of the lack of money. And she couldn't keep up on the painting, so the book fell apart. And I decided, well, if I'm writing, then maybe I'll try writing prose, and got into that. But it's really hard to break into, because if you think everybody wants to be a comic creator, everybody and their brother wants to be a novelist and has a book on Amazon that they've self-published. So it was struggling to, you know, to get anywhere going with that. And I decided to look back at comics and maybe try drawing my own book, since I already have some art background. And so I put myself through an artist boot camp basically for about a year, and felt that by about last October I was ready to start trying to do my own ongoing book that I would write and draw. And that's when the Kickstarter for A Voice in the Dark came about.
Yeah, well, now that you've mentioned the Kickstarter, you've had massive successes with that. And I know Kickstarter has become a massive platform for a lot of creators wanting to get their work out there. You got some really big attention from some big names in the business. And in fact, Gail Simone was one of the people who really pushed it over the line.
Yeah, I've actually known Gail for a number of years from message boards. She gave us a blurb for the book that we were doing through Archaea. And she's been a friend of mine. I've met her at San Diego Comic-Con a couple times. And so when I had this idea and I was going to draw it and everything myself, and I put up some sample art on one of the web, you know, the message boards that she's on, and she liked it enough that she told me that if she had – this was back when she was still exclusive with DC – said that if she had an independent book that she was looking to do, she would snatch me up as the artist in a heartbeat, which really flattered me. And so I said, well, would you maybe talk about my Kickstarter a little bit online and help me get some promotion for it? And she said, sure. And so she tweeted about it a few times. And we were looking at being about 200 to 300% of the goal going into the last day. And then she did a Tumblr post on it, and that just went massively viral. Tumblr, I learned very quickly, is much better for spreading things quickly in a viral sense than like Twitter and other things. So the Tumblr post that she did, we ended up in the last day of the Kickstarter doubling the money that I had going into the last day. I had about $4,500 and was at about 300% of the goal. We ended up having a little over 9,400 and was about 600% of the goal by the time it ended. And that was all in the last day.
Wow, what a success.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So I decided at that point that I was going to take the one issue. See, the Kickstarter was originally supposed to be to help me fund one issue to use as a submission to publishers. Because rather than, I don't know, you know, how familiar you guys are with pitching comics, but when you're trying to get your own series going, the standard is 5 pages minimum of completed art and then a short pitch on what the series is. And I decided that I could do one better and it would look more professional if I gave them an entire first issue so they could see that I can meet all of the requirements. I can finish a book, I can put it together myself, and that I'm that serious and professional about it. And so that was the goal of the Kickstarter, was to do one issue. And because it ended up being so massively successful, I decided to make it a 3-issue digital miniseries that I would then print the trade of, and that would be the reward for the backers. So I printed a 56-page graphic novel that was the 3 issues combined and used that as my submission package to publishers and got picked up by Top Cow.
That's, I mean, it's sort of a dream story for a lot of people trying to get into the business.
It is. It doesn't happen very often. Yeah.
No, it certainly doesn't. So I guess my question is, you know, when you are pitching to someone like Top Cow, you know, did you, was it an initial success? Did you receive any pushback at all? How did you, you know, I mean, because not, you know, I think you've said in other interviews, creator-owned stuff at that time was not necessarily what they were looking for.
Yeah, I started out submitting everything online and sending them PDFs, and was not getting responses from anybody really, publisher-wise, because they get so many emails with submissions that it just takes forever to get a response. So I decided to go to WonderCon in Anaheim and take 12 copies of the trade and pitch in person to a number of publishers. I ended up pitching, I think, to IDW, Top Cow, Arkea, Skybound, Aspen, Action Lab, a number of different publishers. Anyway, and initially the response from Top Cow was that we really don't do creator-owned books. They mostly focus on the Top Cow universe, things like Witchblade, The Darkness, now Aphrodite 9, Cyberforce, things like that. That they have the Mark Silvestri universe, basically, that he's created, and that's their sandbox that they play in. And they let Image Central do all of the creator-owned books because that's what it was created to do. And the Top Cow is kind of Silvestri's playground and Matt Hawkins to a degree as well. And he said, but since you're here, Matt Hawkins said, since you're here, go ahead and give me the pitch. And so I did. And the more we talked, the more I could hear him trying to talk himself into saying yes, even though it wasn't what they do and it wasn't how they normally publish. They don't normally take creator-owned books. He kept saying, well, it's really not what we do, but, and then would ask another question about it. And so over the course of the conversation, I could kind of see him talking himself into saying yes and taking the book. And so he told me that if I got some more offers to let him know, and I got a few other publishers that were interested. And so I let him know that. And a couple of weeks later, he emailed me and said that he had talked to Mark Silvestri and they were going to do the book.
I mean, that's it's fantastic. And you've got the fact that it's coming out as an ongoing as well, the fact that they committed to an ongoing series rather than just a miniseries. Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, you said that the graphic novel was the first three issues, and now you've released this as the first two issues. Is that correct?
Right. As it's coming out through Top Cow, initially when I first was doing the book through the Kickstarter, I was thinking of going kind of in the direction of Fell, where it was going to be a slimline book, you know, like 16 to 18 pages, and be a really short but dense 9-panel grid page, you know, going with a really dense story and a smaller number of pages. But I found that it was expanding from that, so because I didn't want to put out an 18-page first issue and second issue, I decided once it got picked up by Top Cow that I would put out the first issue as a bonus size issue, so it's actually 36 pages of content in issue one. And then every issue after that is between 20 to 22 pages, like a regular comic. So the Kickstarter book that I made is actually issue one and issue two now,
based off of
that. And then all the issues after issue two are new content that I'm making now.
I really wish you had released it as the three, though, because I'm dying to know what happens next.
Yeah, the second issue had a nice cliffhanger to it.
It
and
did.
That's why I decided to make it a full double first issue, because I liked that cliffhanger ending that it had. And rather than cutting it evenly in half, which would have meant that I think issue one would have ended somewhere around, oh gee, where would that be? Somewhere around just after the classroom scene, I think.
Yeah, which is has nowhere near the impact of that
exactly.
last panel.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, this is a really good cliffhanger. I should just make issues one and two, throw it all together into one bonus size issue and have it end on a really good cliffhanger that hopefully brings people back. And think about it that way. So that's what I did. And
well, I'll be there for the next issue because I need to know how this ends.
I have it in PDF. I'll send you the PDF.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, I'll send you the PDF. But yeah, and it basically ends that first story, but because it's still only going to be two issues, it would be kind of ridiculous to put a trade out after two issues. Nobody would buy that. Mm. So what I'm doing is the next story arc starts with issue 3, and I'm basically going to have the first trade be when that story arc is done. And so this first story arc will kind of be the prologue in that trade, with the next story arc that I'm working on right now being the main focus of the trade. So the next storyline I'm working on now is issue 3 through 7, so it's 5 issues. And so the first trade will come out after issue 7, and it'll have all 7 of the first issues.
Cool. All right. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about very quickly was, because it's something that occurred to me as I was about halfway through it. It didn't even occur to me at first, but about halfway through the book. Not only do you have a female protagonist, which was, I was reading going, it's a nice refreshing thing because you don't see a lot of them around in mainstream books. But the other thing that caught my eye about halfway through was it's incredibly racially diverse. I mean, everyone in the book is Asian or African American. Was that a conscious choice, or was that just natural?
It's mostly natural. I've grown up in Arizona and California, so I've been around a lot of Latino and Black communities. I've had gay and lesbian friends in high school and college. I've just always been around a very diverse group of people. Being in a wheelchair, I have kind of found that normal white society, I don't really fit in that well. They don't quite know what to do with me. So I've always found that the minorities and the outcasts and, you know, I fit in easier with those groups. They're more accepting. They don't patronize me, and it's not a big deal about, you know, that I'm in a wheelchair or whatever. They treat me like a person. Right. So I've just always had friends that were Hispanic or Black or Asian or gay. I've always hung out with the punks and the goths and, you know, all the bad element, supposedly, that, you know, people normally tell you not to. I've lived in bad neighborhoods, and I've had, you know, openly known gangbangers come up to me and tell me if anybody messes with me to let them know and they'll take care of it. And so, yeah, I've just always fit in better with people that have more of an outside perspective, I guess. And so, yeah, when I was doing the book, it's kind of a reflection of what I've grown up with and what I've been around and who my friends are. So I have one of my best friends in high school was the only openly gay kid at our school, and this was back in the 90s when that just was not done. And in college, you know, I had an Asian neighbor in the dorm, and I had a punk roommate from Switzerland, and, you know, just all sorts of stuff. Yeah, it's been all over the place. Okay. So when there's a lot of diversity in my book, it's not a what minority can I put in this role? It's just the character kind of, I get the personality of the character first and I let that take shape. And then I just sit there and kind of try to figure out who do they look like, you know, how do I see them? And it kind of grows out of that.
Yeah. Cause there isn't a cookie cutter character in there.
No. Zoe has 3 roommates. One is Hispanic and 2 are white. Of the 2 white roommates, one of them is a really short goth punk girl. And then the other white girl is a blonde sorority girl. So I guess she would be your cookie cutter character. But even her, I end up kind of turning on her head a bit later. She starts out coming across as very much the Valley Girl, California, you know, cheerleader, sorority girl, very much your blonde horror movie trope, but there's a lot more to her that I start to reveal as the story goes on. I'm trying to make all of the characters be more than what they first appear, because they are all based on horror movie cliches, but then I take those cliches and invert them and twist them and play with them to find new things. So you've got the punk girl, you've got the Latina, you've got the cheerleader, you've got that direction is where I started.
I've been saying, and take this in the right way, because it is a compliment. You are kind of playing in Joss Whedon's sandbox, aren't you?
I guess I kind of am, and it's funny because I've come to Joss Whedon a bit late in life, I should say.
Right.
I never watched Buffy when it was on the air. I really wasn't into any of his stuff. And it's not that I wasn't interested. It's just that I never really got around to it.
Right.
And so I only in the last 6 months shotgunned all of Buffy off of Netflix and have really come to truly appreciate the Whedon as it is.
Yeah, because he plays in a very similar sandbox, which is
with a lot of racial and sexuality and just ethnic and cultural diversity, and it's very female driven, a lot of his stories. And yeah, I've had a lot of people tell me that I should get into his stuff and look at his stuff, and I think part of the resistance may have been that I didn't want to find out that I had been aping him all of these years. And part of it also was I didn't want that to start changing what I was doing. I wanted to find my voice. And now that I'm comfortable with what I'm doing and how I tell stories, I'm very much into finding stuff like that and getting into it. And I really do like his writing. I loved what he did with the Avengers. And I really look forward to, future work of his.
Absolutely.
Just when you've got that sort of rich, diverse crop of characters we've just been talking about, my understanding is then transitioning that to the art, you use photographic references. I was looking in some of your samples on your website and looking at some of the montages you do where you're actually transitioning from the photographic references to the finished product. So you're looking, when you're looking for those references, are they people that you know, or are they people that you do you look for specific types of people when you're looking for references?
My photo references, I do all the shoots myself.
Yeah.
So that it's my photos rather than, I know that there's kind of an ongoing war in comicdom over the years. And Rich Johnston over at Bleeding Cool plays with it a lot with the swipe file where reference Playboy covers and Maxim spreads and things like that. And so I try to... And the dirty little secret of comics is most people reference to some degree.
Yeah.
You have to. And especially if you want to meet deadlines and you want to get things done. But I try to reference as much as possible from my own work. So it's photo shoots that I put together with friends of mine who are willing to model and stand in as the characters. It started out, I would just shoot wherever I could. I think issue one, half of it was shot in a Starbucks and half of it was shot, I should say the entire first issue one and two, the Kickstarter book entirely, was mostly shot in a Starbucks and the cafeteria at the college that's right up the street from me. And I used that for pretty much every location in the book because I had to get it done and I didn't really have access to a lot of places. So... I would basically just shoot in a corner of a room and then draw the backgrounds in as I needed them, which is part of why their backgrounds can be kind of minimal early on. And it was with a few friends that I could get together to do it, which is why there's never more than like three or four people in a scene to start. It was just me trying to get off the ground and get running with it. But now with the newer stuff that I'm doing, I have probably over 20 different people on a list now that I can contact. I have been getting support from my local community. I have restaurants that'll let me shoot in the restaurant. I have there's a historical site that's an old mansion that's right across the street from where I live, and they let me use it, the grounds and the outside of the building. They let me use for the sorority house that's going to be a major part of issues 3 through 7. And so the backgrounds are becoming a lot more detailed. I'm having more people in my scenes. I'm having extras. There's a lunch scene where she meets her roommates for lunch, and it's where you really get to see them all together for the first time. And that's going to be in issue 3. And I shot that at a Chinese restaurant just up the street with a sushi bar. And they let me shoot in there early before they opened and gave me free run of the place. And so I'm getting a lot more support that way. But yeah, everything is referenced. I write my scripts and I kind of treat them like shooting scripts for a movie and take the scenes that I'm going to be doing that day in the photo shoot and will block them out and shoot them panel by panel what I need. And then when I get home, I take the photos and I take my pages. I do my panel layouts on the page. This panel, you know, I'm still working from a 9-panel grid so that it's 3x3. So I'll say, okay, first panel is the first row. Entire row is one panel. So it's actually 3 panels combined into one big panel across the top, and it's the establishing shot. And so I drop that photo in, and then panels 2 and 3 are half of the second row each, and I'll drop in 2 more photos, and then I do it like that. So I lay out all the pages with the photos, and then I will go through and draw off of my references and change the people to look like the characters that I need them to be. All the character designs I do separate, so that I've probably had like 4 different, 5 different friends that have been Zoe so far. So that way, no matter who I have that day, the character still looks the same because their face, their hair, their general identity is a template that I created that I can put over whoever it is it's modeling, as long as the model is roughly the right build for the character. So when I'm shooting Zoe, I'll find a friend that's between 5'5 to 5'8 because Zoe's supposed to be about 5'8. And on the athletic build side, so if I have a friend that's within a few inches, I can make them taller, I can thin them down, or add some, you know, muscle or whatever and make it work.
Right.
And then I have Ash, who's short. I have 4 or 5 friends who are barely 5 feet tall. So I have one of them show up to be Ash, the punk roommate. And some of them are a little on the curvier side. Some of them are very thin. Ash is supposed to be a little bit chunky, but in a sexy way. So I just add a bit of curves to the model and, you know, make her body type look right. And I basically work that way. That's how I do it.
The one of the things we haven't mentioned, of course, is that you draw and with the comics entirely with your mouth and the help of a tablet. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the process of actually creating the comic that way, as well as the average amount of time it would take to do an issue, for example.
Yeah, I'm in a wheelchair. I was born with a birth defect that basically left my limbs in locked positions. So my arms are bent up at the elbow and in towards me. My hands are locked down. My legs are bent in a sitting position. And so I'm in a wheelchair. I draw with my mouth. And the tablet has really freed me up. Over the years, when I would draw on paper, I would have to draw flat on the table, hunched over with my nose literally, you know, 2 inches from the page. I have a very limited range and reach in how far I can make my lines go because I can't stretch my arm out. You know, my neck only goes so far. And I make smoother lines side to side than I do up and down. So I would have to constantly be spinning and rotating the paper and pushing it up away from me to get to the bottom of the page and pulling it down to me to get to the top of the page. Now that I draw digitally on a tablet screen, I'm drawing directly onto the screen. It's really freed me up because I can use a program like Manga Studio, which is what I draw in, and I can just flip the image, rotate it, zoom in, zoom out, slide it up, slide it down, all instantly. You know, it doesn't take me all of the physical wrestling around with a book or a pad or even just, you know, an art board to get it to do what I want it to do. I can draw it upright like an easel, so I'm drawing sitting more up. I'm not all hunched over and, you know, messing up my back. And it's just really sped up my process. I can get better lines. I can get smoother lines. It's kind of funny. I've been doing my work on a tablet now for about 4 years, and when it came time to do the sketches on the back of the Kickstarter books, I had to go back to drawing on paper, and my first few sketches I tried doing were terrible because I'm not used to drawing that way. I'm like, oh no, I've ruined myself. I can't draw anymore. And so it took me a bit of practice to get back into shape, so to speak, and I still can't draw anywhere near as good on paper as I can on my tablet. And it's not just a matter of the photos. It's a matter of I'm so used to sitting up and having so much freedom of being able to move and spin and rotate the image and flip things around, and that I don't have any of that when I'm drawing on paper. It's just a lot more difficult. My disability really becomes an obstacle again. Ooh. And it's kind of given me an appreciation for how much being able to draw digitally on the tablet has really freed me up and remove those obstacles was the rude awakening of going back to drawing on paper again.
Just on that, you know, I noticed in the back pages of the book that you say that your tablet was actually donated by Wacom. How did that come about?
I have one tablet that was bought for me by the State of California Department of Rehabilitation, and that was to get me started. And then Wacom, I needed a second one because the one I had wasn't ideal for my situation. I know more about the tablets and how they work now, and I really should have got something different than what I got. So I contacted Wacom and asked them if they would be willing to help, and they said sure, and they sent me one. And I did it by contacting their human resources department, asking them how I would go about, you know, petitioning for one. And then they just told me to email them my story and let them know, you know, what I'm doing and give them some samples of my work. And they decided to go ahead and do it and sent me a tablet and a bunch of pens. And that kind of got the ball rolling from there.
I think you are an incredibly inspirational story for anybody out there who may have a disability. You've just embraced every stage of it and just said, I can do this, and got it going. It's fantastic.
Not least of which other artists who want to break into the comic industry as well.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the things is I just want to ask you is that the book is obviously now an ongoing book. It's being it's coming out from Image Comics in November, I believe.
Issue one is in November.
Issue one's coming out in November, then it'll be monthly ongoing from then. You mentioned that you're plotting out issues through to about 8, I think you mentioned. How far ahead have you got the planning going? Because Cutter's Circle seems like a very complex and dark place to me. How much of that's already in your head?
The town, the history of the town, it's all in my head. I've written scripts all the way through issue 7. I have 3 through 7 done, which is the next storyline. And I've written all of those scripts and gone through editing on them, and I'm in the process of doing the art on issues 3 and 4 right now. Because I have scenes in multiple issues that take place in the same locations, I will shoot them at the same time. So I may do a shoot for several issues at once. Because I'm there, I may as well save time for everybody by getting it all done at once. So I've been bouncing around doing issues in pieces, so to speak, because I'm so far ahead of the schedule right now. Issue 1 won't even go to print until October 22nd, I think, is when it goes to print, and I'm already way past that. Issue 2 will be printed in November something. So by the time issue 1 is actually on the shelf, I will probably be finishing up issue 5 or 6 and be, you know, well ahead of the game, which means that I can afford to jump around a bit and don't have to just get an issue done and hurry up and get it to the publisher, which is kind of nice for them. They're not used to, you know, publishers in general aren't used to having people so far ahead. Comics is a notorious industry for missing deadlines or being up against the wall on deadlines, and I'm kind of an exception to that because I put so much together ahead of time as my Kickstarter. I already have content in the can ready to go. But it's the town is kind of a character in its own right, and it will become more so as things go. With issue 3, Zoe starts to become aware that there's more going on to the town than she at first knew. That kind of gets revealed at that lunch in the Asian restaurant with her roommates, and she learns more about the town than she realized, and kind of comes to the realization that her uncle hasn't exactly told her why he's a homicide detective there, of all places.
Well, we've also got the fact that there is another killer out there somewhere as well.
there's another killer, and he is he will be making more appearances in the next few issues as they go. And the second arc that I'm doing, the one I'm working on right now, issues 3 through 7, is called Killing Game. And it's basically kind of a cat and mouse between her and this other killer that's out there, and becoming aware of each other and landing on each other's radar. And then the third story arc that'll come up after that, which starts with issue 8, really focuses on their dynamic and what they end up being as far as how they meet and what comes of that.
Interesting. I'll be looking forward to reading this.
I appreciate that.
It definitely sounds like we've got a lot to look forward to and get our teeth into as we go on. Laramie, thank you so much for joining us here today on Behind the Panels.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm glad that you guys invited me. Thank you.
So we're looking forward to those issues coming out later in the year and catching up with you again as the series progresses.
Anytime. Just let me know.
Thank you so much.
What a nice man. That was an absolute joy.
I really, really enjoyed it. What you didn't hear, of course, is after we finished that interview, we chatted with Laramie again for another 20 minutes just about comics generally.
And invited him onto our show as a guest host in the future.
He's a big Kick-Ass fan. So when Kick-Ass 3 ends,
we're bringing him back.
Definitely bringing him back for another chat. But look, we really, really urge you to go and check out his stuff. If you want to learn a little bit more about him, go to LaramieTaylor.com. Or you can follow him on Twitter at xlaramiex. Or you can do the best thing, which is go and buy the book, A Voice in the Dark, when it hits shelves in November.
And you won't be disappointed. It's a good book.
And it'll definitely, if you like us, it'll leave you hanging after the first issue.
Yes.
So we look forward to bringing you some more on that. And we've definitely got some more one-shot specials in the future for all the latest. And if you want to listen to our regular podcast, hit up behindthepanels.net.
And make sure you leave us some reviews on iTunes.
Definitely. Until then, I've been Richard Gray.
And I'm Dave McVeigh.
And this is Behind the Panels.
Wrap you in his arms, tell you that you've been a good boy. He'll rekindle all the dreams that took you a lifetime to destroy. He'll reach deep into the hole, heal your shrinking soul, but there won't be a single thing that you can do. He's a god, he's a man.